Now on Food FM, you're listening to Bread and Butter with Caroline Kenyon. Caroline and her guests make sense of the world through food, from politics to farming, making and cooking.
Online, on smart speakers and on Listen Again, this is Food FM.
Hello, I'm Caroline Kenyon, and it's my great pleasure to welcome you to the latest edition of Bread and Butter. And my guest today is an acclaimed author, broadcaster, presenter, food writer, Alex Renton, who has written about all sorts of different subjects. But there's a kind of theme that runs through them all, whether it's about boarding schools, dare I say it, or about food, but it's about humankind and us as animals at the centre of it. And his latest book is about food and the foods that shape our world, 13 foods that shape our world, no less. And I wonder if there's a significance in the number 13. Alex, welcome.
Hi, Caroline. Thank you very much for having me.
Well, it is a delight. Alex, tell me a little bit about the origin of this book. Is this something that's been bubbling away in your mind for some years?
Yes, in the sense that, I mean, you mentioned I've done various journalistic jobs, but the only one I've ever really wanted to do was be a food writer. I just had to fill in the gaps with other jobs as well. But one of my most fun sort of periods as a food writer was sort of in the early 2000s when the Observer newspaper and Nicola Giel launched this wonderful magazine, Observer Food Monthly, where Nicola rather brilliantly would put sort of celebrity chef interviews on one page and then food adventure, exploration, anthropology on the next. And I would kind of do a lot of those pieces. So in those years, I used to do things like I went to Cambodia to write about how you catered for a wedding in one of the world's poorest countries and what kids in slums were eating in various cities across the world. And war correspondent food. And it was, I realised then, I was working for Oxfam at the time, that, you know, I had to write a lot of things about poverty and so on. But it's far more interesting in Gaza or wherever, to say to people, how are you and how are you doing, but to say, what did you eat last night? And why did you eat it? And how did you cook it? And what did your children really want? Because that's a universal and lets you into something we all understand, which is both the worry about getting food and the joy of food.
Wonderful. You're evoking such a great picture of the kind of pieces that you were writing, Alex. And I have to say that as a former journalist myself, I'm feeling a few pangs of envy. They sound like really wonderful, deep veins to mine.
It was such a cool job, Caroline. I was called Asia Food Correspondent for the Observer Food Monthly.
Well,
it's a lovely job.
I'm sort of sighing with envy here, definitely. So just bring us up to this collaboration with the food programme. I mean, anybody who's interested in food obviously knows of the magnificent Sheila Dillon and the brilliant Dan Saladino. So tell me how this book arose. And again, I'm intrigued by this, you know, the 13 foods that shape our world.
Yes, well, let's do that first. So 13 foods that shape our world. I have to admit that... maybe don't tell the publishers I told you this, but there was a big meeting with the BBC market people and the publisher, and I was going, well, I think it could be 12 or it could be 10. And this guy popped up and said, we find 13 gets more clicks when we put it in our lists on the website. We all went, why? And they went, because everyone thinks 12 or 10, you're just rounding up. But if it's 13 ways to please your lover or whatever, it's much more interesting. So I went, okay, fine, 13. And that made it sort of easier because I had more, I could have done 20 sort of thing. So that's, but they are 13 carefully selected foods though. The food programme, I'm old enough to remember before Sheila Dillon and Derek Cooper doing it, that Sheila was his producer first, but and Derek Cooper's books, I well remember, when I was a kid, that his Bad Food Guide, which is, you know, around the time of Elizabeth David, was the first, you know, really funny critical book about British catering. I remember that sitting, you know, it was with its funny cover of flies flying around a plate of bangers and mash. But that, you know, it has been the soundtrack to my life as a domestic cook, that programme. you know, as a young man, when I first, you know, started cooking for people in my flat, that was on in the background. And as a journalist, it just always chimed with me what's fun to eat and why are we eating it is just a key question. And for me, it's some of the greatest of BBC journalism is sort of epitomised in what Sheila and Dan and a lot of interesting news presenters do. And I've always treasured it. That it's critical and sometimes fearless, and also you discover things. So when they decided to do their first sort of spin-off book, and Sheila came along and said, "Would you be interested?" I was just incredibly flattered. I mean, you know, I have been on the programme a couple of times, but you know, that's sort of a real accolade for any food writer.
Absolutely. I mean, this is the gold standard of food broadcasting. I think, we'll get into the meat of the book in a moment, but I mean, one of the things that I love about the food programme, but also about your book, is that you take food away from being a niche issue and you place it right at the centre. Because for me, I'm one of the co-founders of Food FM, and you know, our strapline is changing the world through food, but also telling food stories from around the world. And I have a number of other food-related projects that I run. But for me, I see almost all of life and the world through the prism of food. And I think that's one of the reasons why I love your book, is that you place food right at the heart of things. And it's not something that's, you know, just one of, I don't know, 10 items on a checklist that, you know, where we might consider the world. Is that how you see your book?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think for me, that it goes back to working with Oxfam in disaster relief and so on, is that if you address people's food needs, you start at the very basics of what unites us as humanity, really. I mean, there are only three or four things that we all do and all get pleasure from. And also the fact that, of course, food is a good lens of looking at not just our culture and our society, which is sort of obvious, but also about economics, about the way the world's progressing, about geography, about history, and so on. If you start with the food lens, it's a bit like those actors who say you must start a character by choosing which shoes he would wear. But if you start by looking at a society or a person and say, how do you eat and what do you eat and why do you eat it, that's how you begin.
I love that analogy. I shall remember that one. I might even borrow it with your permission. So, Alex, it must have been a struggle to come up with your definitive list of 13 foods. Tell me about that.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, I determined to write a book that hoped to emulate what a food programme episode does, which is entertain, inform, perhaps get a little bit angry about things that need sorted out, and even provide a recipe. So every food we chose is one which has played and continues to play a very significant role in human not just nutrition, but politics and economics, geo-economics. And we had to, and every one of them is historically interesting, and every one of them is going to be really intriguing as this difficult century progresses and we look at the job of feeding 10 billion people in climate change. So that was the beginning of the filter. Under that, you were kind of going, well, let's not do wheat alone, let's do bread. Because almost every culture has a form of leavened dough that they eat and treasure as well. And it uses different types of grains. And that's kind of more interesting. I mean, there are single issue, single foods. I mean, rice is one in there and salt is another. But sometimes we've sort of gone for compound foods because it works better that way. But, you know, trying to make it fun to read is pretty important. But that's true of any journalism.
Absolutely. It is immensely readable, Alex. I have hugely enjoyed it. And just for our listeners who've not yet had the pleasure of reading, I'm just going to whistle through the foods that you talk about. Bread, salt, oil and fat, dairy, sugar, potato, chicken, spice, tomato, rice, banana, soy and cocoa. I mean, that's pretty comprehensive. I had a couple of thoughts of ones I might have popped in, but of course, whether 15 foods that shape our world would have had the same number of clicks is obviously
Well, it's an odd number.
Yeah. So which are the ones you enjoyed writing most?
Well, I read the things that were most fun to write were the things I knew least about, really. There's some things like, you know, I spent quite a lot of time when I was working in Asia looking at rice and rice culture and how people use it. You know, it is gripping how differently people use rice when, you know, it's what they eat as their primary staple. But no, so areas where I really was quite ignorant. I mean, so in the spices and pepper, it's mainly hot spices chapter. You know, I was really, the story of chilies, incredibly rapid spread after 1492 and the Spanish conquistadors came across it in Central America. And you know, and its move to be a global food took about 70 years. It's big in Asia that quickly, whereas potatoes took about two centuries to catch on, and so did tomatoes after we looted them from the Americas. But I had a lot of fun with spices, not least looking at spices that we've forgotten or ones that have gone out of fashion. Spikenard is an example. So your Tudor ancestors wouldn't have liked a cake if it didn't have spikenard in it. And I came across something wonderful called Silphium of Cyrene, which is, you know, legendary herb spice, the most delicious, interesting, fascinating spice of all time, according to Roman writers like Catullus. But none of us will ever know what it tasted like, because the evil Emperor Nero, who fiddled while Rome burned, ate all the silphium. He ate literally the last silphium plant to be found in North Africa. So that's an example of the first thing to go extinct because of human greed.
Goodness, what a horrifically vivid picture you paint. That is really sort of shocking and disappointing. But also, I suppose, sort of ignites our imagination. And we think, what would it have tasted like? I mean, are there written descriptions of it?
Very little. I mean, there's descriptions of how expensive it was and how much in demand it was. And indeed, Nero's happy munching of the last frond. But what it actually tasted like. I mean, it's some sort of mixture between clove and I don't know, cocoa. And that's another interesting chapter, cocoa.
Yes, course, absolutely. Yeah. So I wondered about coffee and or tea. Were they on your initial long list?
They're drinks, Caroline. They're not foods.
Oh,
that's how I'm
going to
wriggle out of that one.
Yeah, no, fair enough.
You'll find it's funny how many people have said that, actually. Yes, I mean, it would have put... I'm one of the most tricky ones, and again, but for me, fascinating, because I love I love foods that shape the world. It was doing salt, because salt, I mean, a lot of us are aware that salt was one of the first globally traded food products, really from very early. European enslavement of Africans in an organised, where modern way starts with the Portuguese taking West African people to work salt pans off in the Cape Verde Islands entirely, so British and other ships could pick up salt there, sail it to the northeastern Atlantic, and hand it over to ships catching cod to trade back again to Europe. So this salt's incredibly important role in some of the early trading fortunes of Northern Europeans, in enslavement, in all sorts of big issues that still trouble us now. It's gripped me, absolutely gripped me. And of course, the other thing, sorry, without banging on too much, the other thing about
salt. No, it's fascinating.
Well, the other thing, the brilliant thing about salt is, I mean, you know, you and I probably have four or five different types of salts in our cupboard. We might even have a vanilla flavoured one from Halen Mon. But salt is the same chemical, whether you put it on the road or whether you have it in crystal, in flake form, in a beautiful container from the salt marshes of the Gironde. It's a very simple chemical. I mean, you can talk about trace elements and so on, but no scientist takes those very seriously. And you can buy it for £50 a tonne or £450,000 a tonne, depending on the label on it.
I think that's what marketing is all about, branding and marketing.
And that's what a lot of our foods are about,
yes,
as well. And always have been.
I found that, you know, what you were just saying about the involvement of salt and the slave trade is, you know, again, fascinating, but so dispiriting. And I think often one's attitude towards foods can be changed by the knowledge of its history. But as with sugar, I'm a London expat who moved from London to North Lincolnshire, and a lot of our friends are farmers, and they grow sugar beet. And I now, we eat very little sugar at home, like lots of health aware middle-aged people. But I do try and buy English sugar. It just, there's something lowering about, well, you know, for all, there are all the environmental reasons about not bringing sugar across from far afield, but also just the associations of it are not comfortable, are they?
This is a historic taint, which is utter, you know, unavoidable. I mean, it's a really interesting one. I mean, you know, and one of the things that people like you and I, who are now not eating sugar or eating sugar only locally grown, or because of, you know, its appalling health toll and rolling at diabetes and obesity and so on. People like us were not eating sugar in 1820 as a protest against what was being done to African people in the Caribbean to produce it. I mean, there are leaflets saying, I mean, middle class lady committees would go around saying boycott sugar before it is tainted with Africans' blood. So sugar's been a matter of argument and lust and terrible greed and genocide, really, since we started to mass produce it in the early 18th century. Very tainted, still totally ubiquitous, though. I mean, for all that you and I say we don't eat sugar, it's very hard to avoid.
No, it is, absolutely. It's interesting you were talking about the ladies' committees, because I was actually talking to a friend about slavery at the weekend, and he said, you know, we shouldn't be, you know, be judging people then by the, you know, through the prism of our own views now. But as far as I understand it, there was an anti-slavery movement almost from the moment that slavery, as we know of it in the modern world, began.
Yes, I think, I have written about this separately. I have some ancestors who were enslavers in Jamaica and Tobago, and you know, it was perfectly clear that by the 1790s, it was an issue a bit like Brexit. I mean, half of Britain was totally against slavery and petitioning Parliament in hundreds of thousands to stop it. Mm. I don't think those people, my ancestors, and I've read their letters, weren't very different in moral outlook or education from how we are today. And they were greedy. They were Christians. They were greedy, and they found ways to justify enslaving black people to produce the sugar that they made their fortune on.
Yes, it is, as you say, greedy. It is always ultimately about money and power.
It is. It's interesting. And I mean, but and this is, again, you know, I think this runs through the book, you know, that there's a tension between greed and pricing and quality and, you know, bad industrial retail versus good localized and planet friendly and animal friendly retail. I think there's a chapter called Dairy, in which I deal with everything from obviously dairy farming through to white, what they called white meats, which fed the poor, as the author Karenin Steele, who I know has been on your program, points out. So it's through the early urbanisation age, and all the moral arguments around dairy that have always existed, from quality and animal welfare through to damage done to the planet and the environment, are still just as current as they were then. And also that fact that, you know, dairy farming kind of shapes the way a lot of the rural England that we treasure and love looks today, structurally.
Yes, it's interesting. This morning I was recording a programme about afternoon tea and cream teas. Mm. And actually, although afternoon tea seems to date back to about the 20th century, invention.
Yeah.
But there's so much sort of mythology and romance that we weave around these things that people think, oh, it's been going for hundreds of years. And, you know, people were Morris dancing in 1230 and then sitting down to a cream tea. Well, it's absolutely nonsense.
No, that's right. But the sort of rural bucolic lore around, lore around dairy is really fascinating. I got very gripped by the role of women. Well, obviously the role of women in agricultural production is always interesting, but around dairy particularly, where, you know, in the traditional dairy farm, you know, the sort of Thomas Hardy dairy farm, Tessa the D'Urbervilles, the dairy maid, is, you know, her role is is both sort of very menial, but also absolutely crucial. There's also a whole load of lore around witchcraft and menstruation and so on, about when and how butter can be made, which both sort of exploits the women and abuses them, but also, you know, kind of builds them up as well. And you get down to the dairymaid songs, the songs that were sung in order to get the right rhythm for the butter to come, to churn in the barrel. There's a wonderful lost lore of both exploitation and empowerment of working class rural women.
That is so interesting. Alex, thank you so much. I've loved our little canter around your fascinating book. Do you think you might write it in the same way by, you know, let's say you were commissioned again in 2050? Would it have the same 13 foods in it?
It's interesting because I think looking at it, the 13 now would have been the same at pretty much at the beginning of the century. Not tomatoes. We weren't very big into tomatoes 100 years ago, but the beginning of the last century, I mean. But looking forward, I think that all might change hugely. I mean, soya is really the only food that's appeared in my list that is of the late 20th century as a sort of global food, partly because it's shoved into so many basic pre-prepped foods. But looking forward, we know we're facing challenges that we haven't known since at least the Industrial Revolution. Who knows how we're going to feed these 10 billion people who will be on the planet by 2050, and whether eating dairy and really planet damaging products like that is going to go on being either morally feasible or feasible for any but the very rich. Now, that's a matter of great personal regret. I love my cheese. And I love a little bit of beef every now and then as well. But no, I think we're seeing big changes to come. That list will change.
Yes, I think you're right. I think like the spice that you mentioned, which the Emperor Nero gobbled up the very last one, you know, it might be that, you know, by 2050, people will be reading about this thing called cheese or this thing called beef and thinking, I wonder what that tasted like.
That's a terrible thought. I'm afraid it might be possible.
It's possible, but let's live in hope. Alex, thank you so much.
Thank you, Caroline. That was fun.
You're listening to Bread and Butter with Caroline Kenyon.
To find out more about Food FM and our content, go to foodfmradio.com.